Some people plod along through life and thinking, man, it'd be nice to make a difference for hunting. But, you know, I'm just one guy, one girl, one lady. You look at some of the work that's been done by E.O. Wilson. According to Wilson, human beings are hardwired to want to connect to other living systems. I think there's something to be said for that. Now, come on, give me a break. We're using a biased perspective to default out of what's the real problem out there. People saying, well, we've got this newly emerging market of hunters that want to hunt for food. No, it's not a newly emerging market. It's a re-emerging market. That was why we initially hunted. This is Greg Simons with Wildlife Systems, and you're listening to the Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
I've been blessed to harvest 22 of the 29 North American animals with my bow.
My personal 24-hour record for death threats is 88.
They will start putting two and two together and realize this is how you call bulls in.
So when I go hunting now, that's the ethos I take with me. You know, whatever this hunter's going to throw at you, you pull your big girl pants up and you get on with it.
Giant bucks are freaking awesome. They're beautiful. But you know what? I would not trade this first buck for anything in the world.
So I'm a geek. Magicians and dragons and magic swords. I kid you not, man. I'm the biggest dork in the gun business.
I'm Freddie Hartice, Hollywood Hunter.
This is Aaron Snyder.
Hey, this is Trevin Stoltzfus with Outback Outdoors.
This is Rihanna Carey.
Hi, this is John Sloan of the Interviews with the Hunting Masters.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy. Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
All right, y'all. So getting on to today's episode, super excited to have Greg Simons of Wildlife Systems on the line with me today. Greg, thanks so much for taking the time to hop on.
You bet, Sam. It's my pleasure to be able to participate in this podcast today.
You know, I got to say, anytime Larry Wysoon says, you know what, you need to interview this guy, I will take that as some of the highest recommendation a person can receive. So I immediately reached out.
Well, I guess Larry was having a brain fart that day when he brought up my name, but nonetheless, I'll take that as a big compliment. So
I don't know. Maybe it was getting into the whiskey during the podcast. I just didn't catch it.
Could be.
So one thing I'd love for you to start out with is just a general kind of introduction of who you are and how did you get introduced to hunting and the outdoors?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. My degree in college was in wildlife and fishery sciences. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in 1987 from Texas A&M with that degree. So that was really my initial segue into the wildlife field was through my college career. And I had a chance to work on some internships with an individual who was just getting started in the hunting business. So my internships with that individual allowed me to participate in some activities in terms of seeing firsthand the challenges of fledging a new business and what that looks like. And allowed me to meet some people, gain some experience, develop some confidence in being able to try to basically, mimic what he was doing when I was working with him. So when I graduated, I started this company called Wildlife Systems, and it's a company that still co-own and operate today, have a partner that as of about 3 years ago. And And we essentially put together commercial hunting operations on different private lands, principally here in Texas, but we've worked in several other states. We've done some work in several other countries as well. And then I also co-own a company with a guy named Ruben Cantu. Ruben retired from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department as a regional supervisor about 6 or 7 years ago, and he and I formed an LLC called Wildlife Consultants. And we provide tech guidance for different landowners, bank trust groups, do a little bit of expert witness stuff. And he puts more time investment in that business than I do. And I just try to stay out of his way at times and allow him to do what he does well. And then there's another company that I also co-own, a company called Conservation Equity Partners. And I've got a partner in it called Terry Anderson that runs that business, and it's primarily in environmental mitigation, some forestry management over in East Texas, and then some investment in different conservation lands that we work with and develop. And so, but most of my time is spent with wildlife systems and messing around with hunters and landowners and trying to develop these hunting programs.
So now you mentioned this all kind of started with your college degree. What inspired you to pursue that degree?
Yeah, I grew up hunting and fishing. So, you know, naturally I had some interest and some passion there. And then I went to a small high school. There was 40 people in my graduating class. So it was a small school. And I had a high school principal that I was close with, and he had a forestry degree from Stephen F. Austin University, and he and I hit it off well. And during my senior year in college, he one day was like, you know, what are you planning on doing when you get out of high school here in a few months? I was like, well, I don't know. He said, what would you like to do? I said, well, I'd love to work in the wildlife field. And he said, well, have you thought about where you might want to go to college? And I said, well, I'd written a letter to a guy named Al Brothers, who was kind of a bit of an idol of sorts of mine, that he and Al Brothers and another guy named Murphy Bray had co-authored a book in 1975 that was Managing Quality Whitetails, or Producing Quality Whitetails was the title of the book. And Al was writing a byline for Texas Trophy Hunters magazine at that time. So anyhow, I wrote him a letter asking him for some input, some advice, and he responded to me. So, and he had mentioned that Texas A&M University would be a good choice. That was his alma mater. So anyhow, Mr. Fleener, my principal, we loaded up. I think it was the day after graduation, we drove down to College Station, and my SAT scores were not that high. And we went into the freshman admittance department, and he went up to the receptionist, Mr. Fleener did, and he said, who's the head of the department here? And she said, well, that would be Mr. Gail Wood. You know, why do you ask? Is he available? And she said, well, I don't know. Do you have a meeting scheduled with him? And he's like, no, but I'd like to visit with him. So anyhow, she walked back. Came back, and a little while later, she said, Mr. Wood would be happy to visit with you. So we walk into to his room, and they're looking at one another and going, okay, how do I know you? I've met you somewhere. And it just so happened they had went to church together in Friendswood, which is down by Houston, some years prior. So they've caught up on some lost time. And then Mr. Wood looked at me and said, you know, what's your purpose of being here today? And I was like, well, I want to go to school here, but I didn't score high enough on my SAT score. He's like, well, here's what you need to do. You need to write a letter of appeal and state why you want to go to school here, what your career goals are, et cetera, which I did. And then we went over to Nagel Hall, which was the home of the Wildlife and Fishery Sciences Department on campus there. Same thing. There was a guy named Dr. Wallace Klusman that was the department head of the wildlife department. And Mr. Fleener said, well, who's the department head here? Well, that would be Dr. Klusman. You know, is Dr. Klusman here today? Well, yeah. Do you have an appointment with him? No, but we'd like to visit with him. So anyhow, ended up hitting it off real well with Wallace Klusman, actually continued to to work with Dr. Klusman today on a ranch that he has over in Central Texas and been working with him for 25 years. So that was really kind of my weird intro into getting into to college to study, you know, wildlife and fishery sciences. And I guess the rest of it is still history being made.
Well, you know, I think your story really illustrates an important point for people, you know, and whether that's getting into, you know, the outdoors or with anything you want in life, it's one, you have to take a chance, you have to reach out, and you also have to be tenacious. And so, you know, whether that's writing letters to people that you admire and you want to hear back from. And I think the hunting industry is a really great place where you can reach out to people, and you know, not everyone's going to see your message or be able to write back, but you can reach out to people, ask them questions, ask for their advice, ask for their recommendations. And I know of very few where if they're able, they will not respond. You know, it's an incredible place.
Yep. No, that's right. And really it's, you know, life is so full of opportunities that, a lot of people don't realize are looming. And sometimes it's simply a matter of turning over that stone or knocking on a door and taking that step forward. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people that never end up having an opportunity to pursue their dreams and realize some of the opportunities that may have been available for them or were available for them simply because there wasn't that spark, that confidence that they had in themselves at a certain point in time. And then, like, you know, everybody, we tend to get entrenched in our, you know, life. We find a job, have a family, and you look back, next thing you know, it's almost a little too late to feel like you can try to rewrite your career. You're right. There's just life's full of opportunities there. And today, when we live in this world of social media, it's very easy to communicate to people and to seek advice. And that applies to any industry, whether it be the hunting industry, natural resource field, or becoming a plumber or musician or whatever it may be. So.
Well, and you know, you have to some extent not take no for an answer, at least in a certain way. You know, you could have looked at that situation and said, "Well, shoot, my SAT scores aren't good enough. I better look at a different option." You know, I feel like there's two types of people when it comes to situations like that. When you see a roadblock, you're not even necessarily at the roadblock yet, but you see that roadblock off in the distance and you say, well, I better go to a separate destination. I better go somewhere else because there's clearly a roadblock in the way and there's no way I'm going to be able to get past it. Then there's other people that'll walk right up to that roadblock and they'll look for every possible little hole through it, around it, over it, a different route to get somewhere, whatever it takes. And yeah, they may not always succeed, but that type of person is going to get a lot further in life than someone that just changes their goal every time they see a roadblock off in the distance.
Yeah, no, that's right. And there's, you know, in some ways I still feel this way today, but used to, I thought, you know, if I had not been so lucky to have, you know, a couple of individuals that were difference makers for me early on, I would have never got to where I did. And that's largely true. It, the Mr. Fleeners, the Gail Woods, the Wallace Klusmans, a guy named Dick Laros from Allentown, Pennsylvania, that was one of my mentors early on when I started this business. I used to think, God, how lucky was I to have those people in my life at certain junctures, and they were the ones that made a difference for me. But the reality is there's lots of those kind of people out there in different people's lives. And I think that, you know, quality individuals, when they recognize that people are making an effort and that they're maybe reaching out, I think that there's thousands and thousands of folks scattered across this landscape that are willing to provide that bridge, that opportunity, that mentorship that it sometimes takes to be able to have that door opened up. And it's obviously extremely helpful and comforting when you have someone that you feel like is supporting you, providing you with good information and wisdom and kind of help pushing you along. So, and there's lots of folks and there's people in everybody's life that falls into that description in some way. And so I think it's good to recognize that and to seek those people out.
Well, then I think it's also, and, you know, again, maybe call me biased, but I think folks in the, you know, in this hunting world are very good at doing this, but it's also good to remember that, you know, remember those people that you've received that mentorship from, that assistance from, whatever, you know, however you want to refer to it, but then also pass that along and make an effort to find a way to do that for someone else, you know. Sure. That random person you talk to about hunting, rather than just be like, oh yeah, you know, you should go off and do this stuff. But, you know, actively take that time, take them out, even if it's just to tag along with one of your hunts or whatever that may be. I think it's critical to the things we love to pass that, you know. I hate using the phrase. It sounds so cheesy, but we've got to pass it on, you know. Yeah. But it's the truth of it.
We do, yeah. And for years, I've thought and often said that part of being a true professional, regardless of whatever industry you're in, is reinvesting. And you know, reinvesting in people, whether it be young folks like what you just mentioned a while ago, could be young hunters, getting them involved. Reinvesting through different NGOs, conservation groups, sportsman's groups, whether that be the Texas Wildlife Association, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, National Wild Turkey Federation. There's some, you know, as a hunter, as a conservationist, as a person who's passionate about the outdoors, there's plenty of great opportunities out there to reinvest and to make a difference. And I think that that's one of the things that some people that are passionate about hunting, they kind of plod along through life and thinking, man, it'd be nice to make a difference, you know, for hunting. But, you know, I'm just one guy, one girl, one lady. And but the reality is, through groups like that, through those NGOs, your voice can be amplified. Your efforts can be leveraged. And that's what makes a big difference at the end of the day. So, yeah, that's a great point you made.
And what are some ways you would recommend then for someone just getting into this? You know, there's lots of different types of people. And especially now with how widespread information and content is, a lot more people, I think, are being exposed to hunting, whether, you know, for good or bad. What advice would you give to someone that's coming in? And there may be like, I don't know anyone. I don't know. You know, how do I reach out to these people? Who do I look for? How do I pick someone? Like, there's thousands of people that all are self-proclaimed experts on this topic. You know, what insider advice would you have for someone that's looking to find someone to reach out to find mentors?
Yeah, you know, it's you know, having some confidence in your ability to feel like you're not going to be stiff-armed or shunned is certainly one of the first steps. And I think that's often a kind of a false pretense that some people naturally assume is, well, what if he doesn't want to talk to me? What if they hang up the phone on me? What if they don't respond to my Facebook message to them or what have you? But and that can happen. It can certainly happen. You know, successful people are often very busy. And it might be, you know, reaching out to someone that's a friend of your dad's or somebody at church or just somebody that you know, initially is not necessarily an expert, but is someone that you admire for different reasons. And I, you know, that's one of the things that somebody taught me early on was, as you go through life, pick out people that have certain traits that you like, and then try to build those into, you know, the traits that you develop over time. So initially, you know, that person you reach out to, it may be somebody that's just, he's kind. It's, you know, they're a nice person. They respond in a fashion that makes you feel good. And so may not be an expert on the subject, but, you know, if it's someone that you feel comfortable with, you admire that trait, and you feel like they're willing to listen to your questions and provide some, you know, just to be a sounding board for you, you know, it may be something as simple as that initially. And over time, you're going to start, you know, meeting people that are good business people, or maybe they're good teachers, or maybe they have, they're good speakers, and they just have certain talents, certain traits that you admire, and trying to tap on them to glean information from them. And over time, those other key people are eventually gonna surface. And it may be after you get to college and one of your professors that's the, you know, the ornithologist, or maybe he's in the speech communication department that you're, you know, taking a course in, and you end up, again, leaning on them for personal advice. And those people, you know, those people will surface in time. But I think it's a matter of just getting into the process of feeling comfortable to talking to other people around you to glean advice from, or to glean some of the talents that they have that you admire.
You know, one of the amazing things I've realized is in part of running this podcast, I mean, what I do is centered around reaching out to people, and especially people that I've many times never spoken with before, whether that's at an expo, approaching someone and starting up a conversation with them, or reaching out via Instagram or email or whatever that may be. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough to also have my fantastic guests recommend other people to me that I should speak with. But even with that, even with all the introductions and all the reaching out I do, I mean, it's maybe one or two out of five people that I end up eventually getting on the podcast. And so, you know, we were talking earlier about how you need to be tenacious and go after what you want. The same thing, you know, if this is something you really want to do and you really want to learn about and be mentored through, you're going to have to pursue it. People, you know, every so often you'll get lucky and yeah, somebody will hand you some stuff on a silver platter. But the reality is a lot of people in this industry are being approached by a lot of people, and they are going to be a lot more apt to speak with you, to give you their time, if they see that you are hungry and you are passionate and that you really want to live this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It reminds me of a quote that I heard that says something about, the sign on the door of opportunity says push. And there's plenty of doors of opportunity out there. Sometimes you just have to push that door open and pursue it and keep pursuing it. And, you know, most things worth having and being proud of in life don't come easy. And if they did, you probably wouldn't appreciate them to the extent that you do when you know that you've put forth a lot of effort, sometimes made sacrifices, sometimes helped other people succeed along the way. You know, those are the things in life that I think are most rewarding. And then when you start, when you start getting a taste of some of those results, that's additional fuel for the engine that has you stay committed to that process.
So tell me a little bit about Wildlife Systems.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Yeah. Wildlife Systems, in the logo, the rudimentary logo of what we still have in place today was sketched out in a organic chemistry lab when I was a senior in college, thinking more about hunting than organic chemistry, and sketched out this logo for this business concept that I had in my head. But the fundamental concept of the business model when it was started remains pretty much the same today. And that was to develop hunting programs in different private lands, but to not simply be another hunting outfitter. My mother, she cleaned houses to help send me to college. And so I didn't want to get out of college and just be another, Bubba outfitter. And I wanted to use my degree and wanted to offer some things through an outfitting type of company that not just any other outfitter offered. So being able to offer some different wildlife management services along with those hunting services were very important to us early on. And those, that platform, no doubt, it made a difference for us early in the game when we were able to basically suggest and eventually illustrate that we can bring more to the table to you, the landowner, than just hunting revenue. We can bring some things to the table that's also going to help benefit the resources that are found on your private lands, that increase the value of those lands, and that brings, a sense of comfort and some degree of security for those landowners, knowing that resource is being managed and it's not being mined. But that was really largely the basic concept of the business early on, and remains so today. We've taken some of that business concept component out and plug that into these couple of other businesses that I co-own, and try to channel some of our wildlife resource management work that we do under a different business name, but nonetheless, Wildlife Systems, we're still working with almost 1 million acres in Texas on a bunch of different properties that we're not just selling hunts on, but we're also providing some management services as well.
So when you say management services, tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, some of these services can be as passive as sketching out a wildlife management plan that provides a roadmap for the landowners and their people that we're working with to doing game surveys, collecting harvest data, working with other third-party contractors if that landowner's going to be doing some brush management or creating some additional water infrastructure, and working, with some of those other third-party contractors to make sure that those practices are implemented in a way that not only benefits, livestock operations, but also benefits the wildlife operations as well. Those are a few examples of some of the basic game management, wildlife management type practices that we're regularly involved with. We do a lot of wildlife survey work for not just ranches that we hunt on, but properties that we do some consulting work for. Through Wildlife Consultants, that business there, we do quite a few what we call enterprise reports. And it's often working with a landowner sometimes it's a family-owned property. They need a third party to sit down with them, help sometimes mediate discussions, try to get everybody on the same page, try to bring some peace to the discussion. And because when it comes to family-owned properties dealing with ranching or natural resources, it's hard sometimes for everybody to get on the same page. And the next thing you know, there's infighting, there's conflict, sometimes results in partitioning and selling of the ranch, which is very unfortunate. So each year we're involved with multiple projects where we're doing these enterprise reports and working through kind of a process of mediation to try to help facilitate these different family members, these different people being able to get together on the same page and have good synergy and good enthusiasm, which makes things a lot more fun at the end of the day for everybody involved. So we do some of that each year as well.
It's almost very reminiscent of kind of a smaller scale version for private land, what we do across the entire United States. It's kind of interesting seeing how that parallels. It's like a mini private land version of our North American model of conservation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting. What's been the response from the private landowners from that so far?
Yeah, well, the North American model is relatively speaking is a new concept in terms of the formative aspect of it, and there's a little bit of misinformation or misunderstanding out there from people that look at the model and are trying to understand what the model is and thinking that it was a template that someone like Gifford Pinchot or Teddy Roosevelt or somebody back during that era developed and used as a template to help conserve and manage these resources going forward. That's not the truth at all. Really, the model is more a reflection of what a few individuals that were later had many other individuals help refine that model. But Valerius Geis, who's a professor emeritus at the University of Calgary, and Shane Mahoney, who's still a very active international conservationist, it was the two of them that really sat down over time and looked at, okay, what is it about North America that worked in terms of the success of our wildlife resources in this country? What was it that worked that's not working as well around the globe elsewhere? And so the two of them basically sketched out that model, and it's made up of seven different tenets. In time, you had people like, you know, some of the leaders and folks with the Wildlife Society that formed a task force to take a look at the model, kind of help reflect some of the language that is used to talk about the model and advocate some of the tenets and why those tenets are very important here in this country. And then over time, it began, and this has largely come about in the last 25 years and really largely in about the last 10 to 15 years. So the North American model of wildlife conservation is really a relatively new concept in terms of the morphic aspect of it and how it's been brought to light. In terms of private lands, you know, Texas, there's roughly 96% of the land in Texas that's privately owned. So, you know, in one of the foundation, perhaps the foundation tenet of the model has to do with our wildlife resources being a public trust resource, which basically means they're not privately owned, and they're owned by the people of the states to be managed by the states, you know, not only for the benefit of today's generation, but for the benefit of tomorrow's generation as well. So when you start talking about that, you know, these resources are public trust resources, they're publicly owned resources in a state that's privately owned, people's antennae go up real quick. And so trying to then work through that narrative and that understanding that the model and the idea that, you know, that the foundation tenet that wildlife is a public trust resource does not supersede private property rights, and that it's that delicate relationship between the idea that everybody, every citizen in this country has skin in the game when it comes to wildlife, and they do because it's a public trust resource. And that delicate relationship between that and the idea that these private landowners can deny access and they can create these free enterprise markets that allow people to pay to come onto those properties to gain access to those resources. It then incentivizes private land stewardship, which is really, it's that as things stand right now, that is the key to keeping these wild others with us in a country like the United States, because we continue to prove to ourselves we're not very good at managing some of these resources on publicly owned lands, but we've done a superlative job on some of these privately owned lands. Not saying that, you know, that there's not examples of great stewardship that take place on publicly owned lands, but without our private land component of the sustainable nature of our natural resources in the United States, we will not enjoy the quality of life that you and I have been able to enjoy 50 years down the road. So, you know, and that's kind of a long version of, I think, what your question was. But yeah, the North American model, it's great to see that certain universities and colleges are building that into their curriculum. A lot of the NGOs have adopted, the tenets of the model as part of their policy positions. And so it's starting to gain traction in terms of it being a good education tool when we talk about conservation and when we talk about, what role hunters play in that and what role, the public plays in this too.
Well, you know, and here's the thing is, like, I'm not one ever to talk down about public lands. I love hunting public lands. I love the access. I love the opportunity they provide. There's a good chance I would not be hunting nearly as much as I do these days if it wasn't for public land. But, I was just talking with, I had Tim Fallon on, you know, and as of the episode came out actually today, as of the day we're recording this, but had Tim Fallon on recently. And that's one thing we talked about is the incredible job that private landowners have done managing these species. And I mean, part of the reason they do that and are able to do that is because they're able to make money granting people access to hunt these animals on their land. And, you know, we discussed private landowners out of Texas going and repopulating native species back to their native countries, which, you know, that's one of those things that just blows me away every time, you know, every time I think about it. It's right. an incredible thing.
You're right. And there's a lot of different examples that that we could use anecdotally to talk, you know, about this topic that we're discussing right now. But and again, I don't want it to sound like I'm being insensitive about what goes on public lands, because there are many, many examples of great resource management outcomes that we've had on public lands. But when we look at the wildfires out west, and then we conveniently default to global warming as the culprit of that. Now, come on, give me a break. We're taking the we're using a biased perspective to default out of what's the real problem out there, and it's mismanagement of our forested, you know, resources out there, and some of that's taking place on private lands, but on a lot of the public lands out west, where we have not had the mechanisms in place that allow us to manage those timber resources more prudently, that avoid these excessive fuel loads that we now have. And when we get into these wildfires, you know, the scale, the combustibility, the magnitude, it's multiplied because of our inability to manage those forest resources more effectively than what we've done in the past. And like Tim pointed out, there's various exotics that we have here in Texas, whether it be, you know, scimitar horned oryx or attics or dama gazelle or red lechwe, where, you know, some of the the incentives that have been provided to these private landowners in Texas to have those species available on their properties, and the monies that are generated by having those animals available on those properties. And it's typically hunting monies that are the revenue sources that you know, that incentivize those landowners. And then you have certain programs such as, you know, with John Jackson's conservation force, what he calls Conservation Force, his organization. He has a fund that's part of what he calls his Ranching for Restoration Fund, where people pay into that fund. And then, you know, those funds are used to reinvest in those areas, back in those homeland areas where, you know, those animals are from, such as Senegal with the scimitar horned oryx, or some of the other, you know, countries where these animals are native to. So, yeah, that, and those are just a couple of anecdotal examples of what we're talking about here. So,
I mean, I think one thing we can definitely take away from all of this discussion is that for wildlife to thrive, especially in this day and age where, you know, so much of their habitat has been destroyed or turned into housing or whatever it happens to be, and a lot of these animals, you know, people like to admire them, but more than anything consider them a nuisance on the landscape. You know, hunting is necessary for these animals to thrive, for their management, for their conservation, for us, for the funds generated through that, whether on private or private land or through Pittman Robertson or whatever that may be. Hunting is about as critical as it comes.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, I occasionally hear the saying, and it's a good saying, but there's a rest of the line that sometimes left off. But we often, you know, say if it pays, it stays. And indeed, there's we just live in a world where the financial economies are often necessary to be able to protect things and manage them, conserve them for sustainability. But if it was as easy as if it pays, it stays, then market hunting would still be in place because it paid back during the 1800s. So there has to be some balance there. The financial economies are important, but having an appropriate, somewhat user-friendly regulatory environment to help, you know, manage and regulate how that resource is going to be allocated and how it's going to be utilized is part of that recipe. So if it pays, it stays, has some merit, but there's a rest of that story, and a lot of that has to do with appropriate regulatory frameworks that ensure that those resources are taken care of properly, and hopefully have some healthy financial economies that are part of that whole process. And that's when you have a very functional conservation recipe. Then is financial economies that are helping to pay for it. You know, good science that gives us a compass on what direction to rely on how to manage those resources, and then having a good regulatory environment that carries a stick with it to make sure that if you get out of hand, you know, you may have to pay in a different way. Oh, yeah. And so it's a combination of those things that keep these wild others with us, and that hopefully will, you know, for the next 100 years or more.
And so with this importance, you know, I feel like we've been seeing a decline in the number of hunters across the United States in the last several years. And how do you see this as affecting this balance that we're trying to develop of, you know, financial rewards versus all of this?
Right. Yeah, no, it's concerning because it's real easy for us to have the needed information that tells us that up until this point, for almost 120 years, it's monies that have come from hunters that pay for terrestrial wildlife conservation in this country. Yet there are some fractional, smaller amounts that come from other sources, but far and away, and it's a round number, but 90% of the monies that we've historically relied on to manage terrestrial wildlife in this country have been generated from hunting related funds. You know, if you look at the operating budgets of all these different state DNRs, about 88% of their operating budgets as a whole come from hunting and fishing related sources. You know, hunting license fees are a big one. You know, the PR funds that you just mentioned, Pittman Robertson funds, the excise tax that people pay on sporting arms and ammunition, that's a big one. You create a society where all of a sudden, for the first time in 100+ years, we have this descending percentage of our population that's buying license and a descending number of hunting licenses that are being sold. It's very concerning. And fortunately, one of the silver linings of COVID-19, whether it's cause and effect or otherwise, one of the silver linings of COVID-19, almost without exception this year, hunting and fishing license sales have been up in almost every state across the country. And now is that simply because our society had a lid placed on it for several months? And this is how they're responding. What is that? What's the precipitous of that cause and effect? You look at some of the work that's been done by E.O. Wilson on biophilia. Now, according to Wilson, human beings are hardwired to want to connect to other living systems. I think there's something to be said for that. And then when you deny our American society the opportunity to freely, conveniently, at their will, connect to those other systems, those other environments, the appetite, I think, grows even greater. And so when that lid is either taken off or when people just decide, I don't care if someone is trying to put a lid on me, I'm going to go camping, I'm going to go hunting, I'm going to go fishing. I think we're seeing a lot of that. So I think this biophilic nature that we have is being exposed right now in a much more profound way. You look at all the different outdoor industry product lines, retail sales, whether it's camping equipment, hiking, boating, hunting, fishing, all these different outdoor related lines, you know, are seeing record sales right now. And, you know, someone could say, well, you know, maybe it's because for several months people weren't spending much money. They got more money in their bank account now or in their pocket. So they've got more to spend right now. And there's probably some truth to that. But I do think that we have this really neat silver lining that COVID-19 has provided us with. And it's the reality of people now being more consciously aware that those are things that are important to me. You know, I will not be denied my ability to participate, you know, in these activities and in these environments that are special to me. And hopefully we won't see a spike and a trough, you know, because as a friend of mine says, the edge of intensity can cut both ways, and it often does. And but hopefully the spike that we're seeing will remain more ingrained in our lifestyle moving forward, and we'll see the benefits of all this, you know, well into the future.
And I think we're also seeing a lot of people coming to the realization of how dependent they are on these systems that we have, not necessarily, you know, kind of these biophilic systems like you mentioned, but the systems we have in place in society, whether that's grocery stores or, you know, Costco for toilet paper or whatever this happens to be. And they're realizing that, you know, these things disappear, we lose access to them. How am I going to survive? And you know, that's then striking that chord that makes them want to return to that kind of inherent human nature. And, you know, why probably also we're seeing, you know, I think there was already a bit of an impetus to kind of return to that whole kind of locavore movement. But then I think this whole COVID situation really ramped that up with people suddenly realizing that they have no ability to survive outside of having things provided to them.
Yeah. You know, in the history of the human species, and this has been talked about at times in other settings, in our history, you know, there's a tendency for our society to repeat itself in various ways. And I think with the locavore movement that you just mentioned, we're seeing some of that. And 15, 20 years ago, there was perhaps a bit of this mentality with some of our hunting community where people got so focused on horns and antlers and the size of the fish they caught, whatever it may be, that the idea of just going out to hunt for food, that seemed outdated. And that's not where you get your food. You get your food in the grocery store. You know, it's more economically achieved there. It's more readily available. It's convenient, et cetera, et cetera. But indeed, in recent years, you know, I hear some people saying, well, we've got this newly emerging market of hunters that want to hunt for food. No, it's not a newly emerging market. It's a re-emerging market. You know, that was why we initially hunted, was for food. So it's really not a new market per se. I think we're at that point in society where, again, we're starting to come full circle. We're repeating history for whatever reason, whatever the, you know, the precipitus is. But and I do think that our hunting community is now starting to mature in a different way to where we don't look at these people that are wanting to hunt for food as hippies. We look at them as our friends, you know, our people, and we're developing some pretty neat ways of embracing that, programs that help cultivate, you know, that participation, that help make it even more fun, where you're having these different field to fork or pasture to plate kind of programs and parties and events and education pieces and books being written and Steve Ranilla talking about it and his products. And so we're embracing this whole idea of wildlife as a bona fide food source. And by the way, it creates an enjoyable aspect of our lifestyle to be able to participate in collecting, you know, those meats and appreciating the lives of those game animals that we hunt, appreciating the ecology and the conservation practices that are required to sustain those resources. It's a whole process that I think is now beginning to become more clear in people's minds what all that means. And now how do we continue to embrace that in a way that addresses some of these descending hunting license sales that we've been seeing in recent years by tapping into some interests that hopefully in time will favor increased hunting license sales. But I think it's a very important part of the future success of hunting in this country.
Well, you know, we were just, again, talking about Tim Fallon, and one of the things I discussed with him was that new hunter training program he's in the process of developing. And I think what's really cool about that is it's not just the whole, like, okay, we take you out and we get you your first animal. Boom. Haha, you're a hunter now. No, that's getting the animal. You're only halfway through the whole process right there. You know, they train you, they take you out, they get you the animal, but then they teach you how to quarter it, how to take it out of the field, how to cook a meal with it, which, you know, and my listeners are probably so sick of hearing me talk about this, but the most satisfying part in the world to me is that moment when you're sitting down with your family and you've made a meal from an animal you've harvested, and almost to the extent of people don't even realize that it's a wild game animal. It's not this mystical thing. It's just a simple meal, but everyone's just living life and going on and enjoying each other's company like any other day. But you know that you provided that, you were a part of that. And there's nothing in this world that's more satisfying to me than that moment when the family's just sitting around having a meal from something that you harvested.
Yeah, no doubt. The ability to spiritually connect to your food is, I suspect we went through a time along that continuum in the history of this country where we lost some of that spiritual connection. It wasn't as prevalent, you know, per capita within our society as what it probably once was. But when you feel like there is a spiritual connection to the food that you're not just enjoying, but that is supporting, you know, the health of your body, I think it affects our kind of our psychological way of looking at things a bit differently. And I think we become less wasteful with foods. I think that, we reassess how we want to collect those foods. We reassess the healthy nature of some of the foods that we put in our bodies and what that means to our bodies. But I think, as I understand, one of the byproducts of the locavore movement is you have folks that intellectually, in an emotional and often spiritual way, are connecting. They're creating a bridge between hunting and their food for their body in a way that a lot of hunters historically just have not been able to do, or have, you know, taken for granted certain things that kept them from being able to make that connection in that kind of meaningful way. So yeah, I've got to where I enjoy game meats a lot more than I used to. And being in the hunting business, I've always had game meats available to me. And for years and years and years, our family didn't eat a lot of game meats. You know, I was so busy during certain times of the year. I just really didn't feel like, quote, messing with game meats, you know, for our own household. I found it just more convenient for us to buy our meat, you know, from the local grocer. But over the last, particularly the last 5 to 10 years, I've found the game meats being a really important part of my hunting activity and a really enjoyable byproduct of what I personally get out of hunting. And a lot of times it's the animals I've taken, but sometimes I'm so thankful when somebody leaves part of their pronghorn or their elk that I can take home. Mm-hmm. Where used to it was like, that's added work. I don't, you know, thanks for the offer, but let's give it to somebody else. I don't want to mess with it. I want to mess with it now.
You know, I've said this 100 million times on this podcast, but I really think this kind of return to the locavore movement and people having that connection with their food is something that's going to solve so many problems with food, whether that's, you know, whether that's obesity, whether that's health issues stemming from the quality of food, you know, whatever that may be. I think so many of these issues are dealt with when you are connected again with your food, when you, one, know what you're eating, know the quality of it, and two, you know, I've said it before, how many times have you, you know, you've gone to the store, you've bought, you know, some ground, you're having a barbecue, you buy some ground beef to make some burgers out of, or whatever it is, you have an extra thing that you leave in the fridge and you forget about it browns and you're like, well, crap, I got to throw it out. It's happened to me a million times over the past, you know, however many years I've been shopping at a grocery store. Now ask me how many times I've let a single piece of wild game meat in my fridge go to waste. I think maybe if I've accidentally dropped a little bit of grind or something on the ground, that's about the majority that's ever gone to waste when it comes to wild game in my household. And it's because I know the work that went into gathering that. I have respect, an extra added respect for that animal that gave its life to feed me, because I was part of that process. That's another reason why I like processing the game myself. I don't always have time or all the tools to do everything, but it's super important, I think. And I think it would solve countless problems people have with food and eating and health if it was a universal return.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the locavore movement, you know, it speaks to people's health in more than one way. I think that there's a tendency for us right now to talk about the game meat and how locavores are wanting to be part of the process of, you know, collecting these locally grown organic foods. But we talked about some of the work that E.O. Wilson had done earlier in some of his philosophies on biophilia. But Richard Luke, who's, you know, done a lot of work, spent a lot of time writing about what he refers to as nature deficit disorder. And so when we talk about this locavore movement in the healthy game meats that are provided that, you know, enrich our body, and then you start looking at some of Richard Liu's work and how, you know, some of the work that's been done, research that's been done out there shows that people that grow up with meaningful relationships with outdoor settings tend to be more healthy. And it's not just, you know, your basic physical health, but your emotional health too, whether that be anxiety, depression, or whether it be obesity or high blood pressure. I just think that there's something to be said for taking a look at some of the writings that Richard Louv has done in recent years and tying that into this locavore movement and how not only this reemerging side that we're seeing in hunting provides us with healthy food and enriches our lifestyle, but it also puts us in an environment in the outdoors that affects our health in other ways too. And that's where some of this Richard Louv work, I think, I think we need to do a better job of trying to pull some of this together and learn what it really means. And then use that knowledge as a tool for moving forward. But yeah, it's you know, some pretty exciting times in that regard right now.
Absolutely. So, you know, as we're kind of winding down here, one thing I always like to finish up with is, and I feel like we kind of covered some of this at the very beginning of the podcast, but say you run into someone or wherever it may be, and, you know, they know you're a hunter or you're discussing it with them, and they say, you know, hey, I really like what you do, or maybe they are wanting to kind of return to that locavore lifestyle. But they're like, you know, I just don't have any background in any of this. I don't know anyone that does it. I don't know. There's a lot to it. There's way too much for me to figure out. It's really intimidating. I don't know if this is something I can personally do. What words of wisdom would you give that person?
Yeah. You know, and that's one of our big barriers, for entry is, you know, a growing percentage of our society are urbanites. You know, they grew up in the confines of the concrete jungle. And you mentioned the word intimidating, you know, earlier in our podcast. And some people get intimidated pretty easy when they start thinking about, well, how do I go about, you know, getting involved as putting my toe in the water to become a hunter or to experience hunting. And it's a huge barrier for entry. I think that we've developed some programs that help address that. We need to scale them out. You know, some of the youth hunting programs, the Texas Youth Hunting Program is one of the blue ribbon models for being able to get kids outdoors involved in hunting. We need to scale that out. You know, one of the things that that I think we sometimes overlook when we start talking about hunting and getting people involved with hunting is fishing. You know, fishing's hunting. It's just an aquatic form of hunting. Mm-hmm. It's really, I'm not going to say it's no different, but it's hunting. And so when you have opportunities for access that are more easily gained, sometimes more affordable to access those things in public reservoirs, rivers, different areas that provide fishing, that in itself is a segue. And then when people begin to experience that and begin to experience taking the life of of an animal, whether it's aquatic or terrestrial, you know, that's part of the process. And then they begin to see that there's, you know, one of the end of the means is a food source. And when you start, you know, I think there's several fingers that come off that. One is the appreciation for life and the appreciation for death and what all that means. But two, using that as maybe a suggestion for how people can get involved with hunting. Well, have you ever fished before? No, I really hadn't done much fishing. Why don't you try that first? It's economically, it's not quite as expensive. There's a local reservoir down here where you can go catch some sunfish and try that, you know, and let's talk again in, you know, in a few months. And I think that we need to be a little bit more, I won't say creative, open-minded on how we provide those portals and how we try to plate that up for certain people to get into that process of moving forward. And then eventually, you know, if they don't have a gun, either borrowing a gun or buying a gun, learning how to shoot it properly at the gun range, that's part of the process. And then finding a way to take to the field with it, to hunt, you know, small game or birds, and not worry about having to go hunt big game immediately. I think we sometimes place too much emphasis on big game as the first taste of hunting when, you know, in recent years, we've tended to overlook, you know, rabbits and squirrels and doves and, you know, small game. But we can play this game smarter. And we can play it harder once we learn how to play it smarter, because one will tend to feed the other.
Well, Greg, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and speak with me today. If people wanted to find you or Wildlife Systems online, where can they hunt you down?
Yeah, well, they can find my picture at the post office. And now just go to our website, wildlifesystems.com is our easiest way to find out who we are and what we do, wildlifesystems.com.
Fantastic. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time today. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely, Sam. I appreciate it. All my pleasure.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com/174 to get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher. And head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from The Wild Initiative family, and more.